You're listening to the Body Pros podcast coverage of the 2008 ICAC IDSA Joint Conference. The conference took place in Washington, D.C. from October 25th through October 28th, 2008.
Hi, this is Dr. Ben Young from Rose Medical Center in the University of Colorado in Denver.
And this is Bonnie Goldman, editorial director of thebodypro.com.
We're here at the 2008 ICAC IDSA meeting in Washington, D.C. I'd like to spend the next few minutes going over some of the key concepts that emerged from important presentations at this meeting. There are many themes discussed at ICAC this year. We'll focus on some key areas.
Dr. Young, why don't you walk us through some of the studies that you thought were most important at this conference?
Be happy to do that, Bonnie. This was a very big meeting with many attendees. I found several areas of focus that brought together consensus and areas of controversy. Let me try to give you some of those themes first, and then we'll come back and talk about individual studies. First was a series of presentations that looked at the effectiveness of highly active antiretroviral therapy in the parts of the world where people do have access to life-saving therapies. There was a second group of studies that helped us define when to use therapies in specific clinical situations, namely in patients who have active opportunistic infections, and a very fascinating presentation that readdressed the question about when specifically people should start therapy with higher CD4 counts. Another subject area that seems to be emerging and previously underappreciated in these meetings were special populations of patients. We'll talk about a number of studies that addressed issues of disparity of access to care and some of the important and frankly devastating complications of poor access to care. Lastly, I'd like to discuss a theme that's very important to me in the clinical management of patients in our practice, and that is, how does one take care of patients who are diagnosed with HIV who are older, or patients who have survived into their fifth and sixth decades with often many years of HIV therapy? This gets to the point or the emerging issues of primary care medicine and HIV medicine.
It sounds like you're going to cover a nice assortment of materials. So let's go back to HeartWorks. What were the studies that popped out at you in this category?
There are three major studies to me that highlight this point and really provide an exclamation point to the fact that highly active therapies continue to work. It's been now 11 years since the first publications of studies that show that we could suppress virus. It was a study from Frank Pallella and our colleagues at the CDC that showed in 1998 that patients who received antiretroviral therapy actually had decreased rates of death and decreased rates of complications. The CDC and John Brooks presented an update 2008 of this same cohort, 10 years after the original publication in the New England Journal. And in this study and presentation, Dr. Brooks showed us an analysis of the 7,800 patients who continue onward in the HOPS cohort. What he showed very clearly and reproducibly was that the death rate remains low in this cohort of patients. In the HOPS cohort, Dr. Brooks showed us that the incidence of high-frequency infectious opportunistic infections decreased in 1995 and 1996 and remained suppressed through the 2006 analysis point. So the rates of all cytomegalovirus infections, pneumocystis pneumonia, MAC infections have remained low. This was an important observation because there was concern that highly effective therapies would be effective for a while, but then they would stop being effective. So even in this population of patients, as imperfect as patients are with difficulties with drug resistance and non-adherence, therapies continue to work now, entering into the second decade of highly active regimens.
So this reflects the reality of most clinicians are seeing in their practice.
Yes, and in fact, it's very much what's happening in our practice. In the same presentation, Dr. Brooks showed us data about the frequency of malignant complications of HIV, namely Kaposi's sarcoma, a non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, cervical cancer, and CNS lymphoma, again showing persistent decreases in the frequency of these events, again suggestive of long-term benefit to patients that receive therapy. An interesting analysis in the study also looked at the CD4 count at the time of the presentation of these opportunistic complications. What was a very interesting point here was that there seems to be a change in the CD4 count at time of presentation of certain complications. So while the median CD4 count at the time of diagnosis of cytomegalovirus and pneumocystis remains the same through this chronological period, the CD4 counts that were seen for non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, for Kaposi's sarcoma, and HIV encephalopathy actually has increased over time. This suggests there might be a changing natural history of these diseases in the U.S. population.
What are the numbers that you're talking about?
For example, in the early heart period, the median CD4 count at time of diagnosis of a Kaplan's sarcoma patient was 38. In 2001, it was 107. In the 2002-2006 time frame, it was 143. So we've seen about a 100-cell increase in the median CD4 count at time of Kaplan's presentation. Again, similar changes were seen with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, initially starting with a median count of 73, and most recently, the population had a median CD4 count of 243.
Do we understand the mechanisms?
We don't. I think, again, it speaks to the unmasking of new complications and an evolving natural history of HIV disease and an evolving natural history of the management of patients. We'll actually talk more about this later in our discussion.
That was the HOP study. Were you going to talk a little bit about DUET and Benchmark as well?
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, both of these studies are important. And to put this into context, in the early days of highly active therapies, it was easy to show survival benefit because there were so many patients dying of AIDS complications. Anything that improved that death rate could be measured in prospective clinical studies. As we saw the frequency of death from AIDS complications decrease, it became increasingly difficult to demonstrate a survival benefit in prospective clinical studies. So for the last 10 years, we really have not been able to demonstrate that critically important point in clinical studies. The first of these studies is the DUET study. DUET is a study that was presented by Richard Halbrich from University of California in San Diego. In this study, patients received either etravirine or placebo, and all patients received ritonavir-boosted darunavir and optimized background therapy. To be eligible in the study, all these patients were very highly drug-resistant and had very limited treatment options. This represents the patient population that might be at higher risk of having an opportunistic infection. In brief, and we'll go through this in a little greater detail, the study showed that there was a statistically significant survival benefit and a statistically significant benefit in prevention of AIDS complications. In the DUET study, there were approximately 600 patients in each arm. In the overall patient population, almost 10% of placebo-receiving patients developed an AIDS-defining event or death in the 96 weeks of the study. In contrast, only 5.8% of patients receiving etravirine had a AIDS-defining event or death. So again, it's a statistically significant improvement in the risk of having something very bad happen to patients. And this, again, is consistent with the idea that if you give people effective therapies, you can actually improve their risk of serious complications, improve the risk of death. So there were several important and, I think, corroborative analyses in Halbrich's presentation. The first was to show that there was a strongly statistically significant difference in the time to having that adverse event or death. There was a decreased proportion of patients who were hospitalized in the study after the 48 weeks. In the placebo arm of the study, 23% of patients were hospitalized versus 17% in the treatment arm. And last, there was an analysis that looked at the cumulative number of hospital days over the 48 weeks of study, showing, again, a strongly significant difference in the number of hospitalized days in the group. Again, remember that there were 600 patients in each arm. 2,700 hospital days were experienced by the placebo arm of the study. By contrast, 1,700 hospital days were spent by the etravirine-receiving patients. To recap, the study showed a significant reduction in AIDS-related complications or death in the patients who received etravirine plus optimized background when compared to patients who received placebo and optimized background. There were fewer cumulative hospital days, and the time to having a complication was significantly prolonged if you received active treatment. So these together suggest to me that if you give people active therapy, you can keep them out of the hospital, you keep them healthier longer, and you prevent them from getting sick and dying.
So we knew that before based on experience in the clinic, but this actually demonstrates it for anyone who is not seeing what's the reality for most people.
You're correct in that this is an observation that is frequently made in parts of the world that have access to medicines, where doctors and the healthcare systems understand the value of antiretroviral therapies.
I guess what I was trying to get at is DUET with the registrational study, mm-hmm. and the drug was approved because patients' viral load were suppressed. Right. So this study seems like an afterthought.
This was a secondary analysis in the study, for sure, because the study was designed with the intent of demonstrating that etravirine actually was able to lower viral loads and CD4 counts. It's very different to say in a prospective clinical study that you can actually prevent AIDS or you can prevent death. And that's a much more powerful statement, a statement that has not been made in many recent clinical studies. So I actually think that this is a very important study. And Halbrecht didn't get enough credit for the presentation that I think makes an important point.
Was the raltegravir study similar?
Yeah, Joe Aron presented a follow-up analysis of the Benchmark 1 and 2 clinical studies. To remind you, this was a study that gave highly treatment-experienced patients either raltegravir or placebo plus optimized background. Dr. Aron showed us this analysis and showed, again, that there was a difference in the time to the first AIDS-defining complication, a difference in the time to death, and a difference in the time to the first AIDS-defining complication or death as an aggregate to endpoint. Overall, in the study, there were 37 patients who had a clinical endpoint of either an AIDS-defining complication or death. 660 of the patients did not. So not many patients had a clinical endpoint. In the end analysis, those differences between the two treatment arms did not meet the full criteria for statistical significance. From a management perspective, it's reassuring that when we see new drugs and new drug classes come forward, that not only do they work in reducing the surrogate markers that we always follow in the clinic, but actually do work in the larger sense of our main objective, which is improving life and preventing death.
I guess it should be underlined that both these studies, DUET and Benchmark, were in highly treatment-experienced patients. In looking over the Benchmark data, that the people who did get sick, their average T-cell count was like 50.
Right.
So very treatment-experienced people.
In fact, these are patients who might, in the absence of these kinds of very aggressive diagnostic testing and access to therapies, many of them would have otherwise gone on to die. We actually have very few patients, I think 3 patients in our practice now, who have detectable virus on treatment. What this means is exactly the observations that we're seeing in a more controlled prospective fashion in these very big studies.
So a triumph of HIV medicine.
Absolutely. Triumph for HIV medicine and drug discovery. Then the biggest single improvement in the prognosis of a very at-risk population that we've seen in modern medical history.
Let's switch on when to start. The question of the year.
Now that we've established and reestablished that HIV therapies work, the question is who gets those therapies and when do you use them? I should certainly point out that this discussion is really about those patients who have access to medications. And it would be, frankly, irresponsible to ignore the fact that most patients in the world who desperately need HIV medicine still today in 2008 don't have access to them. And the result of that is countless millions of people who suffer and die. With that gloomy backdrop, though, let's talk about what's going on here in the United States and Western Europe. And I'd like to start that discussion with a presentation that was a review. Andrew Zalopa from Stanford University recapitulated the results of the AIDS Clinical Trials Group 5162 study. For many, many years, it's been assumed that patients who had active opportunistic infections were too sick to receive antiretroviral therapies. So, in fact, it was codified in U.S. treatment guidelines and international guidelines that you would start ART after patients had recovered or at least completed therapy for their opportunistic infection. This question about starting at this point, though, was until recently never fully understood or fully evaluated. So in this study, patients were randomized to either receive early or immediate antiretroviral therapy and during the time when they were receiving treatment, acute treatment for the opportunistic infection, or to antiretroviral therapy after the completion of treatment for that acute opportunistic infection. Overall, just under 300 patients were enrolled in the study. Again, they were randomized to get either immediate or deferred treatment. Most of the patients in the study had pneumocystis pneumonia. There were a few patients who had bacterial infections and other major AIDS-related complications, cryptococcal meningitis, histoplasmosis, and so on. It's important to note that these patients weren't just a little sick, they were really sick. Within 30 days of entry into the study, about a third of patients had a second or multiple opportunistic infection. The baseline CD4 counts of these patients was just around 30. So again, a very sick patient population. The very population of patients, actually, where this question is a really urgent one. Overall, the study team worked really well, and they got patients in the immediate group. They received antiretroviral therapy within 12 days of enrollment in the study. Those who deferred treatment started therapy about a month later at day 45. About 85% of patients received a boost of protease inhibitor during this phase, and 15% received a non-nucleoside-based therapy. The primary analysis of the patient looked for the time to AIDS progression or death and showed very strongly a statistically significant difference between these events, where patients who had immediate initiation of antiretroviral therapy had a much better prognosis with decreased progression to a new AIDS event or to death.
A powerful message.
Absolutely. And it flies in the face of the idea that these patients were so sick that they would have more complications from medications, that they would have immune reconstitution reactions and so on. In fact, the likelihood of having an IRIS event was the same in the immediate versus deferred group. So overall, again, in this country where patients have this kind of distribution of complications, namely mostly pneumocystis and not a lot of tuberculosis, this strategy seems to be very, very well established now.
I guess you should mention TB is a different story.
TB may be a different story. We actually don't know this. We know that TB immune reconstitution reactions are quite common and can certainly be very devastating, as I see in my travels to Eastern Europe. This is the number one most common complication and a frequent cause of mortality among patients receiving therapy in Eastern Europe and as well in Africa. There have been a series of smaller studies that have actually tried to address this question in populations of patients who have more tuberculosis. And the data from those studies, while smaller in sample size and power, are consistent with this observation that the fear of IRIS and the fear of the other management complications that come along in these patients should not be a reason to withhold antiretroviral therapies. What this means is that patient who's in the hospital with a severe pneumocystis pneumonia, the patients that we used to wait to start therapy until they finish their 21st day of treatment for pneumocystis, these are now the patients that we initiate therapy as soon as it's reasonable to do so. One of the studies this year that has fundamentally changed the way we take care of patients in our practice. There aren't too many studies that actually do that, so this was one, and it was good to see this. What this translates to in treatment guidelines is, in fact, that the U.S. treatment guidelines, the British treatment guidelines, the International AIDS Society USA treatment guidelines all now recommend initiation of therapy for patients with the exception of those with tuberculosis, given the absence of data, but they recommend starting therapy as soon as possible. There was a small study, but one that I think also is instructive, and that comes from Stephen Berry from Johns Hopkins. And this study looked at the risk of hospitalization as a function of time after starting antiretroviral therapy. This is a cohort of patients from the Johns Hopkins HIV group, overall about 1,200 patients in this analysis. So a large study and from a very credible group. What the group did was to look at the frequency of hospitalizations after starting therapy and what time did patients enter the hospital. That makes two simple points. First, if patients did not have response to highly active therapy, that they continued to be at risk of hospitalization, presumably because of complications. That risk of complications was the same over the first year after the initiation of therapy. By contrast, in the majority of patients who responded to the therapy, their risk of having a hospitalization event was present for the first 45 days, the first month and a half of treatment. Thereafter, it dropped dramatically and was about half the risk in the following period of time. So when we start people on therapy, it's important to watch them closely for that first month or two, and thereafter that risk goes down. What that means clinically to me is that we should keep a close eye on those patients after we start. It just reiterates the idea that these patients remain at risk, not just for the first day after they start therapy, but for some period.
Could you describe some of the hospitalizations for these patients?
They don't tell you why they were hospitalized, actually.
What sort of complications did they see in the first 45 days?
The group actually didn't elaborate in any detail about the kind of hospitalization. It would be fair to assume that in a population of patients whose average CD4 count was 150 when they started, that a significant chunk of them were probably AIDS-related or at least HIV-associated symptomatic complications. But what they did elaborate on was also an important point. This is a preamble to our later discussions around access to care. Certain patient groups were at significantly greater risk of being hospitalized, irrespective of time. And namely, women were about 40% more likely to be hospitalized during their first year of treatment. African Americans were 86% more likely to be hospitalized, more so even than infection drug users, who were about 56% more likely among responders to be hospitalized. So it means that as doctors, as healthcare systems, we need to much more adequately address and figured out systems that get women into better care, African-Americans into better care, injection drug users, and so on. It's a matter of trying to identify the patients at greater risk for having complications.
There was another study that was the most talked about study at the conference. You know, what a buzz this study created.
Right, and this is a study from the North American AIDS Cohort Collaboration Group, or otherwise known as North American Accord, and presented by Dr. Kitahata from University of Washington. This study was a cohort of cohort studies from North America and represented a very large population of patients in observational databases. The study was aimed at trying to ask the question with a large sample size as to what the optimal time to start therapy was. You can remember that over the years, we first watched our thresholds and recommendations for starting therapy go from 500 down to 350, down to 200, and the most recent versions of guidelines now are up at 350. The real question is, are we sure that 350 is the optimal time to start therapy with today's therapies, with today's patients, or is there a redefinition of that? The group was interested in testing the hypothesis that starting earlier might have a survival benefit or a disease morbidity benefit. So North American Accord looked at all HIV-infected individuals with a CD4 count between 350 and 500 and who had active follow-up for a 10-year period of time between 1996 and 2000. Again, a kind of study that previously was very difficult to do because you couldn't find enough of these patients in one large study. The groups were compared then whether they started therapy immediately, as defined as starting therapy within a year and a half of the first CD4 count in that window, or patients who deferred therapy. And that means patients who didn't start until their counts fell below 350. As I alluded to, this was a very, very big study. There were overall almost 8,400 study patients that were followed for almost 25,000 patient years of follow-up. The largest cohort study to be conducted in North America. The patient demographics are probably not surprising for a North American population, about 80% male, a young middle-aged population with a median age around 40. Only 40% of the population was Caucasian. The median CD4 count of the patients when HART was initiated follows the study definition. So the patients who started therapy immediately had a median CD4 count of 420. Those who deferred therapy had a lower count, of course, and that count on median was 275. A count, by the way, which is actually higher than we'd see in many patients who actually present for therapy for the first time, but nevertheless, a large enough group to help us answer this question. Again, reflecting the time capture in the study from 1996 to 2006, many of the patients started on therapy. Approximately 40% started on non-boosted protease inhibitors, as was done in the time. Only around 10% initiated therapy with a boosted protease inhibitor. 35% about started on a non-nucleoside-based therapy. Again, the study looks at this question of whether to start or defer therapy in those patients with CD4 counts between 350 and 500. The endpoint of the study wasn't a soft endpoint. It was an absolute endpoint of mortality. So this is really looking at survival. And what the results were, I think, were very compelling. If patients deferred therapy, as defined in this group, the relative hazard of having a mortality outcome was increased by 70%. Strongly statistically significant in a cohort of 8,500 patients. An increased risk of death was also associated with being older, perhaps not surprising. And reassuringly, being female and having a lower baseline CD4 count was not associated with increased risk of death. The major point here is that waiting to start therapy, when your counts are in a range above where we currently recommend therapy, were associated with an increased risk of death.
Were you surprised about that number?
Personally, no. I actually think that the reason that we tend to wait to start therapies is based mostly on the older generation of drugs that had a lot of toxicity and a lot of risk for patient non-adherence. So we often talk about the idea that HIV is one of the few diseases that we wait for disease to advance before we begin therapy. It would be like waiting for the tumor to metastasize before you start chemotherapy for cancer. That doesn't make any sense, and it doesn't make any sense for HIV. The only difference is the balancing of the risks of therapy versus the risk of the disease. So here with newer therapies and a larger patient cohort where we can ask this question with some precision, we can actually show that when CD4 counts are below normal, that by treating the HIV, you can bring them back presumably to a more normal range and therefore decrease the risk of even subtle HIV complications. But in this case, the hard endpoint of death.
So it's redefining what a healthy immune system looks like, and 350 is not it.
Well, 350 is the lower limit of normal, which means that only 5% of people have normal CD4 counts below that. But that doesn't mean that that's the average CD4 count. That means it's the lower limit of normal. So the difference is that in previous studies, we could only show benefit of initiating therapy when CD4 counts were below 350. And again, these studies were largely compromised in their strength because of the size. And this is a study that, because of its sample size and because of its analytical methodology, I think really deserves a lot of attention.
It certainly was the most talked about.
Yeah, I think this was potentially one of the most important studies of the meeting.
So do you think they're going to do a randomized trial anytime soon? I know there's the START trial where they want to actually look at when to start in a different kind of way. Or should we just say this is the study that it will do it, will convince people that patients should be on therapy earlier?
I think you raise some really important questions. And the START study will be hopefully a well-powered study that will more answer this question in a prospective fashion. It's really a question of what the omission of treatment might lead to. Delaying therapy increases risks, a risk of HIV. Starting therapy too early causes risk of toxicity from therapies. And so it's a matter of balancing those two risks in not just populations of people, but in a single individual. So it will take us a long time to get this question answered in a really rigorous scientific fashion. I think personally what this means for me, if I were a patient or I was counseling a friend or a family member, is that there is clear guidance that when the counts are below 350 in asymptomatic patients, that therapy should be started. And there is compelling but perhaps not confirmed data that there may be benefit to start sooner. And it gets back to some of the older discussions around, shouldn't you just start therapy in patients who are willing to be adherent, who understand the risks and benefits of therapy, and who are properly monitored by medical professionals who have been well-trained. And I think that the risks in those patients of starting earlier today in 2008 are much less than they were even 5 years ago with the kinds of treatment options that we have and the better understanding about management. So if it were me, short answer, I'd probably start sooner and probably start somewhere around 500.
Until the next study that shows that you have to start at 800 or some impossible number where there are no patients who ever walk into a clinic with a very, very high T cell. I mean, it's unusual.
It's unusual, but certainly not unheard of. And again, we focus a lot of the attention on the minority of patients who present with CD4 counts of 50. I would point out that there are patients who present to my practice with CD4 counts of 700. And this study provides some guidance for how to counsel those patients. It says that it may not be so bad to start sooner than later. For those patients who are really concerned about that, as I have patients, as we start to talk about depletion of gastrointestinal immunity, issues about long-term complications related to HIV viremia, whether that's cardiovascular disease, neurocognitive disease, and so on, I'm not willing to say that earlier treatment is such a bad thing. We will mention a little bit later about malignancies and such. Again, malignancies happen because of sustained immunodeficiency. And so anything that decreases the total time at which a patient has decreased immunodeficiency, to me, at least at first principle, makes sense. Again, it's just balancing off that theoretical benefit versus the theoretical risk of toxicity and complications. And until we have defining clinical studies, we have to use clinical judgment, best intellect, and the discussion that's individualized to the needs of one patient at a time.
Uh-huh. And in fact, I think the guidelines, they don't recommend against starting treatment.
Absolutely.
At any T-cell count.
Absolutely.
They say it depends on the discussion between a patient and his or her doctor.
Exactly. And often, actually, most of us who are busy clinicians will just look for the summary tables. And the summary tables only give you the bare minimum. It's in the details of the text of treatment guidelines where you really find out about management at the individual level. And it is an individualized decision. And there are plenty of circumstances where the guidelines fully endorse initiation of therapy in patients with very high CD4 counts, namely pregnancy, namely after high-risk occupational exposures. And so there's, in a sense, it doesn't say that you shouldn't treat people. It's just a matter of balancing those risks and allowing patients to make those decisions in an educated fashion. Mm-hmm. We've seen in these three studies further refinement in the discussion around when's the best time to start, what kinds of conditions might influence those starting factors, and so on. But I think, again, these represent significant improvements and advances in the way we think about this very, very important question. Let's focus attention now on some of the emerging or underappreciated areas of HIV clinical management. among these many areas, the ones I found most interesting at ICAC this year were discussions around, first, around women and disparities in access to care for women. And then this emerging subject that I'm very interested in, which is this topic of the interface between traditional HIV medicine and antiretroviral therapies, and more complex questions around the long-term management of patients as they age, as they survive into their second, third, and fourth decades with HIV.
Okay, so let's look at the issue of women and HIV. I'm always surprised at these conferences to see a growing number of studies presented about women. That didn't used to be the case. 5 years ago, there was just hardly anything. And now there's more and more interesting studies.
Yeah, the increased number of studies about women and HIV were reflective of the changing demographics of women in the HIV populations here in the U.S. as well as in Western Europe. Of course, well recognized that the HIV epidemic in many parts of the world, in fact, most populations of patients in the world really have a roughly 50-50 gender distribution. It's really the North American and Western European epidemics that have this gender inequity. Let's talk about some of the presentations here that focused on issues related to healthcare discrepancies, gender inequalities as they relate to women. This is a introspective view of really where in this country where we're not quite getting it right and where we need to do a better job. The first poster presentation I'd like to review is one from Sally Hodder at the University of Medicine and Dentistry in New Jersey in collaboration with investigators from across the United States. This study was a survey of about 700 women who were recruited through a national network of AIDS service organizations and conducted a survey with those patients. Now, all of those patients were women living with HIV. What the study showed was that it was not uncommon for women to feel that there were significant cultural, ethnic, or language barriers between them and their healthcare providers. This difference was even further heightened among women of color. African American women or Latinas were more likely than Caucasian women to feel that culture, ethnicity, or language impacted their healthcare. This problem was least common in the West, but more common among Latinas and African Americans who lived in the Northeast, South, and Midwest. But nevertheless, overall, about 40% of women in the study said that these cultural and ethnic and language issues impacted their healthcare.
I thought one of the things that was interesting about this study was that this is all in the HIV world, and I think that if we looked at disparities in the same population, in the non-HIV world, we'd probably find the same thing.
I think you raise a really excellent point, Bonnie, that this study was only looking at HIV-infected women. In fact, if you ask this question, my assumption would be that, yes, you're right, that similar issues and problems arise irrespective of HIV status. In fact, I think the interesting study would be to compare HIV positive to HIV negative women and their perceptions of healthcare access.
So the question then comes to mind, is this a function of the stigma of HIV that practitioners don't have an understanding of this population of HIV? Or is it that there's still this great divide between healthcare providers and their patients of color and who might be also poor?
I don't think the study answers that question, but I think it highlights that there probably is a problem. It's just a question of how much it influences any particular circumstance. Perhaps related to that question, though, is a third analysis that looked at the likelihood of a woman reporting that there were these problems of culture and language and such, really, but stratified by the type of doctor that the patient called their care provider. Namely, was the care provider a infectious disease specialist? Was the provider a family practice or general practitioner? What the study showed was that there was a statistically significant improvement in the likelihood of these so-called bad feelings if the provider was an infectious disease specialist, namely an HIV specialist. So that suggests that HIV specialists are a little better at addressing these concerns than the general practitioner, who may see fewer patients with HIV or fewer patients with the same demographical makeup of women of color living with HIV. Perhaps as an extension of Sally Hodder's presentation that said that there were some challenges to the way women access care and how doctors talk and interact with women, was a more disturbing study that came from a collaboration between Marsha Lilly Blanton and Valerie Stone at George Washington University and the Massachusetts General Hospital with other collaborators. And what this study did was to look at the influence of race, drug use, and health insurance among the receipt of highly active therapy in HIV-positive women. So again, the effect of these demographical factors on whether the doctor actually prescribes treatment. In short, what they showed was that, in fact, yes, it did matter, that women of color were less likely to get therapy than those who were Caucasian. Women who were using drugs were much less likely to receive therapy than those who were not. The analysis looked at 445 patients in 2002 and 390 women in 2005. To me, a very depressing statistic was the proportion of women who were otherwise eligible to receive treatment who were not receiving treatment. 30% of women who should have been on therapy in 2002 were not receiving therapy, and essentially the same number in 2005. So nearly a third of women who might otherwise be receiving therapy, for whatever reasons, doctors' perceptions, patients' unwillingness to take medicines, access care issues, things like that, still don't receive therapy. And these are the very patients that we just talked about earlier that at least should be on therapy. They would benefit from therapy from not just a quality of life standpoint, but actually from a mortality standpoint. We need to do a better job here. Dr. Stone concluded that there were persistent, substantial disparities in the use and access of antiretroviral therapy among racial and ethnic minority women compared to white women. And this just, to me, is a real area that we must do better. We must understand the basis of it. And that's both, that's a systematic challenge, but as individual doctors in the clinic, it really says that we should look carefully at ourselves when we are offering therapy and counseling people of color, counseling women about the need to be on therapy and so on.
This is a growing theme out of cohorts out of St. Louis, out of Johns Hopkins, you know, different clinics like that.
Right. And I'm sad to say that I'm not surprised. We work very hard to try to provide the most egalitarian, the least gender stigmatizing, discriminatory environment in our clinics. And I don't think that the clinics that were involved in this study feel any differently. But even in those kinds of university environments where we have women investigators trying to find the answers to care issues for women, we still find these discrepancies.
And it's sort of ironic because in national health statistics, women access care a lot more than men.
Yes. More frequent visits per patient per year. And despite that, we see these kinds of problems. So I think the problem lies in the perceptions, both from the patient perspective and from the provider perspective. And again, as we'll talk about here in a moment, an area that really needs a lot of refinement. The last study that we'll talk about that focused on women, there were many studies around women's access to care and demographics, was a very sobering study that was presented by Dr. Rana from Brown University. It was a study that was conducted in Mississippi. And what the study did was to look through a retrospective chart review of all of the women that were enrolled in the perinatal service at the University of Mississippi Medical Center in Jackson. The study identified 275 women who, over the course from 1999 to 2006, delivered 297 babies. The demographics of the women in this study, again, reflect the underappreciated demographics of the HIV epidemic in the South of the United States, namely that the median age of these women was 25, 99% of the patients reported heterosexual transmission as the route of acquisition of HIV, 89% of these women were Black and non-Hispanic, 40% of the women had attended grade school or in high school, but had not graduated from high school. And only 4% of these women were college graduates. And so this snapshot is one of a very different demographical makeup than the populations of patients with HIV in California, in New York, and Florida, the traditional epicenters of HIV in the United States.
Dr. Young, you forgot to mention, I thought, a most important point, and that was that I believe a very high percentage of these women were unemployed.
Absolutely. In fact, in a country where most people receive their third-party insurance through their employers, the very fact that most of these patients were either unemployed or underemployed really speaks to this. So in their analysis, 31% of the women were unemployed, 53% had where there's no data, and I presume that probably means they're unemployed as well, but we don't know that for sure. Only 5% of the women stated that they were employed full-time. 8% said that they were part-time employed. So you know, you can look at it a number of ways, but really we're talking about a very poorly educated population of women who are very poorly employed, and one can only imagine what that implies for their overall health risk, never mind the specifics of having HIV or being pregnant with HIV and all of the additional medical management concerns that this brings up with prevention of mother-to-child transmission.
I believe all the women were Medicaid patients, so they had no real source of income. So they were having a child without any money, which is just a striking picture in itself.
Yeah, absolutely.
So add HIV to that mix and the stigma of that in the South, it's a heady mixture.
Yeah, absolutely. And more to this point, 37% of the women in the study were diagnosed with HIV during their pregnancies, in a sense. So their HIV-defining event was their pregnancy. So imagine the social and medical turmoil that this has to create in a newly diagnosed individual. Aside from the demographical characteristics of this population of patients, which I think is very sobering, the more sobering analysis looked at how they did and what was their access to antiretroviral therapy. How successful was that? Again, remember that I think we all in this country appreciate that access to HIV therapies during pregnancy effectively prevents transmission to child. So the goal of the medical systems and the goal of healthcare providers should be to get these women under care and initiate combination therapies as soon as it's feasible to try to drive viral loads to undetectable levels at time of delivery. Well, that was only achieved in 67% of these women. Effect of that was that there were 14 transmissions among the nearly 300 deliveries, an overall transmission rate that's just under 5%. And the overall transmission rate in the United States is far less than 1%. So those differences, to me, represent a significant area of unmet need and, frankly, individual catastrophe that we need to try to understand and do a lot more for. So the systems here, to me, failed those 14 children at the very least, but I think it really speaks to a very troubling patient population that is underappreciated in the United States in terms of the medical community, our jobs. It's a significant area for social support, governmental recognition. Systems really do need to work on this, and it's perhaps a sentinel sociological symptom of the simple fact that an awful lot of African-American women here in Washington, D.C. have HIV with a prevalence rate that actually matches that of Port-au-Prince, Haiti, a frequency that's higher than any other region in the United States, a frequency that's higher than many of the capitals of developing world countries where we accept that HIV is epidemic and pandemic. So I'm very, very concerned that we are missing the ball here. We have this very shining silver train at the platform that's highly active antiretroviral therapy. And this train is leaving the platform to allow patients to live older and well. But there's a significant population of people in the developing world, but also here in the United States, where the train's leaving the platform and they don't have tickets. There's actually some really other important points to this study. The first is that 70% of the pregnancies concluded with a tubal ligation, a rate that's far higher than the general population. So the issues and notions around family planning and such clearly are different than the general population. I have my concerns about how those discussions were proffered to women, particularly many of whom were probably diagnosed with HIV very recently. Moreover, many of the children were lost to follow-up or had suboptimal postpartum care. So among the 195 women with known HIV at time of pregnancy diagnosis, 27% of their children had fewer than 3 postnatal visits in the year following care. These are children born to HIV-positive women, children that should be theoretically receiving postnatal antiretroviral therapy. You don't get antiretroviral therapy with only 3 or fewer visits. So the children are getting suboptimal care. And then lastly, a significant number of these women are just lost to follow-up. So the systems don't address the social needs, clearly don't therefore address the unmet medical needs for this patient population. And terribly to me, seem to be reiterating a lot of the challenges that we have and continue to face in Southern Africa, the challenges that we see and face in Central and Eastern Europe and Central Asia. parts of the world where a lot more work has to be done, the very fact that this is happening here in the United States, to me, is a very, very sad point.
And it's a lesson to all the people who think that we're very successful here in America and we have to go help the people in other resource-poor countries because they need our help now because we're done. We're successful. I think that this is just one of many, many studies that take a picture of a part of America that is not being looked at.
Part of America that many of us don't want to look at. It's perhaps not surprising, or maybe it is a commentary that most of the research being done in these patient populations is being done by people from the north and not by investigators and doctors within the region that's most affected. And I'd like to see the day when we encourage local providers to recognize the problems and to help become part of the both investigative solution as well as the on-the-ground treatment solution to the problems. I hope that day comes soon. Okay, so now we've talked about a very difficult set of circumstances and areas of unmet need. Let me try to somehow elegantly transition to a different area that is another area of emerging concern, an area that I think is going to receive a lot of attention, and that is namely this interface between HIV medicine and an aging population, a surviving population of patients. Certain kinds of non-AIDS malignancies seem to occur in greater frequency among HIV-infected. Among those include lung cancers, colorectal cancers, adenocarcinoma of the colon, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and clearly squamous cell carcinomas of the anal rectal canal. In that context, it's probably notable that there have been a number of studies in the last couple of months that have addressed the question about how good are we as medical providers at doing routine screening for these very common cancers that we actually know how to screen for. We published a paper looking at colorectal cancer screening utilization. Only 2/3 of patients in our center where colorectal cancer screening was recommended had actually received it. So 1/3 of patients were being under-screened for colon cancer. Similarly, a study presented here from the group from the Mirion Hospital at Brown University looked at breast cancer screening in the HIV clinic. And there were 223 women in this clinic who would have been eligible for a screening mammogram. Only 23% of them had that done. I think that we provide pretty good care in our center in Denver, and I know that the group in Providence is an exemplary HIV clinic. Nevertheless, in these two centers where we try to provide high-quality care, a significant number of patients aren't getting the background recommended cancer screenings for people without HIV, never mind those who have HIV with higher risk.
Do you think this is a function of no insurance for it or no time to do it or the patient doesn't want yet another procedure?
There are clearly multiple reasons why people fail to get cancer screenings. The first is that the doctors don't talk about it and don't offer it. And that turned out to be probably the biggest reason why patients in our clinic weren't getting their cancer screenings. Patients who are very sick and have AIDS complications, neither the patient or the doctor wants to talk about or is concerned as much about cancer screening as they are about taking care of the pneumocystis, for example. It turned out that was a minority of cases. Patients are reluctant to talk about cancer because they're worried about other things, or they're too busy. Again, paradoxically, it's the patients who survive to older decades of life with HIV often return to other activities in life, like jobs and family, and they get more busy with things that are not related to their health and preventive medicine and more related to other activities. And as a result, they become less engaged in their preventive health measures. And so again, it says that individual patients probably have a different constellation of reasons, but that doesn't obviate the need to make sure that people get just the routine stuff. I actually think that we will be seeing a heightened sense of need for screening for colon cancers and other types of cancers, and not less. So if anything, we need to be doing a more stringent job in screening patients with HIV for these kinds of malignancies than a less stringent job. Just another area where as we move away from being AIDS doctors and where antiretroviral therapies become much better tolerated, we need to be devoting more attention to the implications of survival, long-term survival with HIV, and the complications that brings. Finally, I'd like to conclude our discussion to talk about bone disease. And bone disease is something that has not captured the attention of medical researchers in HIV until very recently, but a problem that very clearly has been around for some time, Some of the first investigations for this were done by Pablo Tebas almost 10 years ago, where he noted problems with bone mineral density with patients living with HIV. Over the last 2 or 3 years, there have been an increasing number of clinical observational studies that ask the question of the frequency of abnormalities in bone mineral density, namely osteopenia and osteoporosis. One of the more compelling stories came from Turner Overton in the CDC's SUN study. This was presented last year, looking at over 500 patients living with HIV, and found that the overall prevalence today of abnormal bone density was over 60%. So a very large population of patients today have problems with their bone mineral density. Previously, it was questioned whether this was of any clinical significance. We have now seen unexplained vertebral fractures in patients in our practice. When these patients' bone density was interrogated by DEXA scans, we found previously undiagnosed osteoporosis. Consistent with our clinic's observation was a publication from Steve Grinspoon's group in Boston that showed that in a population of about 8,500 HIV-infected individuals, the overall frequency and risk of having a vertebral, wrist, or hip fracture was about 60% higher than the general population. So while we didn't see these kinds of fractures 5 or 10 years ago, we're now starting to see them, and the clinical cohorts are now beginning to report these things. So this is a very real disease, and it's here now, and I'm very concerned that we need to improve our ability to diagnose and treat this disorder.
Does anyone yet understand the mechanisms? And
we know that abnormalities in bone mineral density come from many factors. Much like cardiovascular disease, there are non-modifiable risk factors like one's gender and ethnicity. There are modifiable risk factors, things like smoking and tobacco use are associated with decreased bone mineral density. The question, in a sense, is why do HIV patients seem to have a much greater risk of these events than HIV negatives? Is it HIV? Is it HIV therapy? Is it some mixture of all of those things? And so at this conference, there were three presentations I'd like to review that addressed this question. The first was a study from the Edward Hines VA Medical Center in Illinois, a study that, in a sense, gave us an expected outcome. And in brief, what this study showed was that HIV patients who have low testosterone levels have a greater likelihood of having abnormally low bone mineral density. It just reaffirms the idea that what we've known from the so-called healthy population doesn't have HIV, that low testosterone levels, hypogonadism, is one of the risk factors associated with low bone mineral density. So that means in our practice, and what we've been doing for many years, every one of our patients gets testosterone levels checked at baseline. And in symptomatic patients with fatigue or issues with hyposexuality, we check their testosterone levels annually. Now we've got another reason to check testosterone levels, namely risk of abnormal bone density. There was a small study from the Mount Sinai Medical Center in New York, authored by Dr. Childs, that looked at vitamin D levels and bone mineral density. This study, again, reiterates the idea that multiple factors are associated with abnormal bone mineral density and suggested that an evaluation of vitamin D levels and perhaps parathyroid hormone levels would be useful in the early assessment and diagnosis of abnormal bone health. The investigators postulated further that there may be some relationship in these abnormal conditions and treatment with tenofovir, a drug again associated in studies with accelerated loss of bone mineral density, but not associated with fractures to date. Overall, again, these two studies look at circulating markers that we can use in the chemistry lab to try to find or identify patients that might be at enhanced risk or greater risk of having bone mineral density issues and or fractures. So that takes us to the study that generated the second most discussion at this conference. And that namely was a study that was presented by Birgit Grund and collaborators from the University of Minnesota for the SMART study group. Most of you will recall that the SMART study was a study of continuous viral suppression versus drug conservation or intermittent therapy. The strength of the study was that it was a very large sample size of patients and were followed with either continuous treatment or not so that one could ascertain the effect of treatment versus no treatment on various markers. In this case, the investigators were interested in looking at the effect of intermittent therapy on bone mineral density. One might postulate, as is often popular, that since HIV drugs are known to have toxicities, that patients who are off therapy should have better bone health. And in fact, that was what was seen in the study. The patients in this subgroup analysis were those patients who received DEXA scans through the 4 years of the SMART study. What the author showed by looking at changes in the bone mineral density in the spine, either by DEXA scan or by CT scan, or changes in bone mineral density in the hip, was that patients who received continuous therapy had greater degrees of bone mineral loss than those who had intermittent CD4 count guided treatment. The basis for this is not known. It certainly suggests that antiretroviral drugs may play a role in loss of bone mineral density. It's important to point out that patients in the study received a variety of treatments, and the investigators were unable to find a single causative drug among all of the various treatment regimens. I think this study raises some very challenging questions that while it may be better to be off therapy with regard to bone mineral density in the SMART study, being off therapy was also very strongly associated with increased risk of death and cardiovascular disease events and so on. So it's a matter of balancing off a lot of complex issues if this conclusion is correct.
So a lot of very interesting studies.
Yes, it's reassuring to me that in the second decade of highly active therapies that we continue to try to refine both the short-term implications of treatment and the long-term potential complications. We've seen very good studies show that we can improve the mortality and morbidity of patients, even those who are at the greatest risk of death, namely those patients with multi-drug resistance. And that to me is very important because, again, those represent some of the most challenging patients that I take care of in our practice. The data from the ACTG and from the North American Accord groups, I think, provide the impetus to really ask more detailed questions about when we start therapy. And some of those answers today, I think, are much more compelling than they were only a few months ago. The story about women, particularly women of color, to me, are very disturbing and need much more attention, both from a research standpoint, but also from a clinical day-to-day perspective. Lastly, my patients are clearly living longer, living old like me, and all of us are becoming more concerned about the long-term implications of preventive medicine in our fifth and sixth and seventh decades. And so there's an emerging awareness of those new needs and challenges as they affect patients living with HIV. And for us as care providers, how we take care of those people and how we try to provide optimal management and preventive medicine for patients, hopefully as they live even longer.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks, Bonnie, for the opportunity. And I'd like to especially thank the many investigators who shared with us their poster presentations and their slide presentations for discussion. It's without those contributions to us that we couldn't have this discussion here tonight.
The opinions expressed by hosts or interviewees in this podcast do not constitute professional advice, should not be considered substitutes for professional services, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of Body Health Resources Corporation or its sponsors. Please see the full disclaimer online at thebodypro.com. If you have comments or questions, please contact us.
Thank you for listening to this report from the 2008 ICAC IDSA Joint Conference. For more coverage of this conference, visit us online at thebodypro.com/ICAAC2008.